The battle against Alzheimer's takes a turn with the announcement of a new drug treatment. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's called Aduhelm, but some are questioning how well it works. We're going to talk with a brain doctor at the University of Miami who advised on the clinical trials. Is this the start of winning the battle over Alzheimer's? Also, we're still in the pandemic, but people are dating, and they're dating a lot. Two dating experts join us to discuss how to approach new romance during the new normal. And finally,
what kind of life will this dog have if it lives with me? I think that's the most important question anyone can ask themselves.
Helping our dogs deal with anxiety now that many of us are back in the office. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Millions of people across the country suffer from Alzheimer's, a degenerative disease that impacts our elderly population's basic brain functions. Florida's home to an estimated 580,000 Alzheimer's patients. That population is expected to grow by 25% within the next 5 years. But there may be hope on the horizon. For the first time in nearly two decades, the FDA has given accelerated approval to a new drug, Aduhelm. It's to treat the disease. However, some in the medical community are skeptical about whether the drug even works. Dr. Jim Galvin is a professor of neurology with the University of Miami and the director of the Comprehensive Center for Brain Health in Palm Beach. Dr. Galvin was also part of an early trial run in South Florida and an advisor to Biogen, the company that created the drug, and he joins us now. Dr. Galvin, I appreciate the time, and this a really important issue for so many people here in South Florida, and I'll admit that also I have a connection to this story as well. But, you know, given the questions, given that there are questions about the efficacy of this drug, how significant is this news?
Well, thank you for having me, and a great question. So I think that the approval of this medication is a tremendous win for the millions of Americans who are living with Alzheimer's disease and for their families. I think it really is the beginning of a change gamer by introducing the first new therapy in almost 20 years. It's going to make a huge difference in how we approach the disease going forward.
Why has it taken nearly 20 years for a new drug to come out? You know, funding, research, what? Why that long?
Well, Alzheimer's disease is a very difficult disease to design a treatment for because the principal thing that happens is people's memory and thinking abilities change. And so the requirement traditionally has been, in order for a drug to be approved, you have to show some benefit in improving memory and thinking. But this is a very difficult thing to study. If you think about the disease as a degenerative disease, it's like chasing a moving train. You know, every day the patient is changing a little bit each day. And so now you're trying to give a medicine that's trying to catch up with this train that's running ahead of them. And it's been very, very difficult. I think the FDA's decision here to do it under this accelerated approval plan really may open the door for new ways to approach Alzheimer's therapies.
All right, I want to talk about this drug, but let's just start with this. Help us, remind us of the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's.
Sure. It's a great question. Dementia is a general term. It means a change in memory and thinking functions from the way the person used to be that interferes with their everyday living activities. Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia. So there are hundreds of causes of dementia, but Alzheimer's is the most common cause. So dementia is a general term. Alzheimer's is a specific disease. All Alzheimer's is dementia, but not all dementia is Alzheimer's.
Okay. Now, my understanding, just from the reading of some of the early reports, so the main thing that this new drug does, Aduhelm, it reduces the amount of a certain protein in the brain that leads to Alzheimer's, right?
That is correct. The protein is called amyloid, and as it deposits in the brain, it's thought to be the trigger or cause of Alzheimer's disease.
There were two different trials for this drug. What did the first trial show? What the drug was able to do? Was it to decline the amount of our mental capacity in Alzheimer's, or what was it doing that it was? And because it was the first trial that really led to the FDA saying, "All right, let's go ahead and push this forward."
Well, there are two studies done at the same time. One was based in the United States, and one was based in other countries. And so the two studies collected similar information. People had took the drug or a placebo, a sugar injection, and then they either we tested their memory and we collected other markers of disease, MRIs or imaging of the brain, PET scans, which are nuclear medicine studies to look at the amyloid, that protein deposit in the brain, and some people had spinal taps to measure that protein in their spinal fluid. One study met its primary goal. That is, it demonstrated a clinical benefit. So people who were on the medicine, the Aduhelm, did better than the people who were on the placebo. They were better in their global, in a global sense, in overall sense. They were better in their memory and thinking test. They were better in their daily functioning, and they were better in their behaviors. The second study, they did not meet that primary goal. They did not show a clinical benefit in terms of their memory and thinking. Now, there's a lot of reasons why that might have occurred, and the company, in conjunction with the FDA, has studied these things. And so there is an understanding of why the study wasn't positive, but the fact is it wasn't positive.
And that's
both studies showed that the drug removed amyloid from the brain, though. So that's what was seen in both studies, but only one study showed a clinical benefit.
And that's where the controversy is, right? Is that usually you have to have two studies that show, you know, something positive before you can move forward, but there was only one. So, I mean, why would the FDA then jump forward like that?
So, again, this is the debate. This is why there is such the conversation going on, because you're absolutely correct. Traditionally, you need two positive studies to get FDA approval. These studies were both stopped prematurely due to something called a futility analysis. That is, it was a planned analysis or peek at the data to see if they would have hit their outcomes. And the decision in 2019 was that the studies likely wouldn't hit those outcomes. So the studies were stopped early. Later on, looking at the data, they realized that one study was positive and the other study was not going to be positive, but they understood the reasons for that. But you're right. Generally, you need two studies. This approval, though, is different than what we just talked about. This is called an accelerated approval. What you had to demonstrate for an accelerated approval is that the drug, Aduhelm, hit its target, which is removing amyloid in the brain. And so that's what's called a surrogate or proxy marker of the disease. This is the same pathway that most cancer chemotherapy drugs are approved through.
And do you see this happen rarely, or does it happen more often maybe than we know, when the FDA does have that accelerated approval?
Well, this approval has been available since 1992. And again, it's the pathway that many cancer chemotherapy agents go through. That is, if the drug shrinks the tumor, that's probably a marker that there's some benefit, even if during the study, the drug didn't demonstrate the benefit. It does require that after approval, though, there has to be a study to demonstrate benefit. And if that study fails, FDA has the right to withdraw the approval.
Okay. Again, I'm talking with Dr. Jim Galvin, a professor of neurology with the University of Miami and the director of the Comprehensive Center for Brain Health. The FDA, again, recently approved the drug Aduhelm to treat Alzheimer's, the first time a drug has been approved in two decades. You can read more about this new approval on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so Dr. Galvin, like any drug, you got to ask the question, what are the side effects?
There are side effects. All drugs have side effects. The most common side effect, and this is seen in medications in this entire family, so other medicines that are being tested, is it can cause some brain swelling in about 39% of people. And small hemorrhages or little micro bleeds in the brain in about 19% of people. Most of these were asymptomatic, but they are things that have to be watched very closely.
I come back to what you said a little while ago when you used the train analogy. And I'm wondering, where are we right now scientifically in understanding dementia, but specifically Alzheimer's and the causes? Have we learned a lot or no?
Well, we've learned a lot. There's researchers around the world, many in South Florida, but throughout the country and the rest of the world that are exploring this problem, trying to figure out what the causes are. And if we understand the causes, then we can develop treatments to, you know, change those causes. But it's a difficult disease. Unlike treating high blood pressure, where blood pressure is a very easy thing to follow. You take your medicine, your blood pressure goes down. It worked. It's very difficult to demonstrate a benefit when you're testing people's memory. What you're looking for is their memory less worse than it was before, not whether it's better. And that's hard. And that's what's really delayed the ability, I think, to find medicines that are effective, because we don't have good ways of looking at whether a drug works well or not.
How is this drug taken? How do you apply it?
So this is an infusion. It's an IV drug, and it looks like the from the package insert, it's a monthly infusion. So every month someone would have to go for an injection of this drug, and it'd be administered over an hour through a vein.
How long before it's available to the public?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think anybody knows the answer. We have some idea approximately of how much it likely is going to cost, but we don't have a good sense of when it'll first be available to be administered to people.
All right, and you talk about cost, and I mean, I've seen numbers ranging up to $56,000 a year. What do we know about how insurance is going to cover this?
So we don't know the answer to that yet. We haven't heard anything from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services as to whether Medicare will cover it. Many third-party carriers will follow the lead of Medicare. So I think that's going to be the big question. And I'm sure, I have no inside knowledge, but I'm sure that these negotiations are ongoing since the approval.
Now, I think like anything, the first of anything is not going to be the best. Usually it's, you know, from trial and error, you know, we learn and we make better and better medicines over time. But granted, I can also understand people's desperation. So are you hopeful that this first drug, you know, is going to be accepted right away by the public?
You're absolutely right. So I think these are conversations that are going to happen between every patient and their provider. I think the public's going to embrace it. I think scientists are 50-50. There's a large group of scientists that are opposed to the approval. I think clinicians, physicians will be somewhere in between. I think each of them are going to have conversations with their patients. There has to be a first before there can be a second. There has to be a first before there could be a best. This is the first. This is opening the door for a tremendous advancement in the field.
And I think what I've read that there are other companies working on, you know, their own medication on this. But just to note, you were paid advisor for Biogen for this research. And I'm wondering, how do you remain independent in your analysis given the finances involved? I mean, would you endorse a different drug if the patient might get better results?
So as a clinician, you want to provide the best care for your patient. So I was an investigator on the clinical trial. We do not get paid for that. After the trial was over, I did provide some consultation to Biogen to help understand the data from the trials, and I was paid for my time there. But I think the greatest important fact is that I think each physician has to have a conversation with their patient, and we want to provide and prescribe the best drugs for that patient to treat that patient's specific symptoms. And that's my approach to patient care.
You know, you think about all the folks who are suffering from this, from Alzheimer's here in just the state of Florida. What do you say to them, but also to their families, what they should consider before pursuing any kind of treatment strategy?
Well, it's really important to think about One is to make sure that a person has Alzheimer's disease as opposed to some other cause of dementia, because this drug was only studied in Alzheimer's disease. And although the indication is broad, it says for Alzheimer's disease in the studies, it was only done in people with the mildest forms of the disease. So it's unclear whether people in the more advanced forms of the disease would benefit from it. And I think we need to make sure that each person understands what the medicine can and can't do from what the knowledge we have. What we do know it will do is remove amyloid. What we don't know is how much clinical benefit there will be. And that's the point of doing these post-approval studies that are going to be starting.
Hmm. Have you found any evidence that there are treatments for Alzheimer's that don't require medication, or just perhaps anecdotal evidence?
Well, there's a great body of literature increasing. A lot of our research focuses on this in lifestyle changes. So one for potentially the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. So being mentally active, physically fit, eating a heart-healthy diet, staying mindful, having social engagement. These things all appear to reduce the risk of disease. But even for people who have the disease, these approaches may lessen the burden of the disease. It's not going to change the disease, not going to stop the disease, but can significantly lessen the burden of the disease on the person living with Alzheimer's disease and on their families as well.
A fascinating piece of news for a lot of folks. Could be very promising, something we'll definitely be following. Again, speaking with Dr. Jim Galvin, professor of neurology with the University of Miami. Read more about Aduhelm, the new FDA-approved drug to treat Alzheimer's. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Dr. Galvin, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And again, a story that we'll keep following. It affects so many families, and I could speak from, personal experience as it affected my family as well. Well, still to come, let's change things up just a little bit. We are still in the middle of a pandemic, right? Yes. With millions of Floridians now vaccinated, though, is it time to start dating again? We want to hear from you. 1-800-743-9576. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It seems like a lifetime ago, doesn't it? Dating, it meant being physically close. You know, you'd share some popcorn at a movie, you're sitting next to somebody, you know, at dinner or at a bar. Meeting new people and looking for love has always been a little daunting, or maybe for some of us. Throw in social distancing, masks, the fear of catching COVID, and it just doesn't seem that sexy anymore. We've assembled a panel of experts for some advice on dating during a pandemic, because let's remember, we're still in a pandemic. Dan Silverman is known as the Miami Matchmaker. He's also a dating coach. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
And we're also joined by Tammy Shackley. She's a matchmaker who works with clients from all over the country and specializes in queer relationships. Tammy, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Lewis. We're happy to be here. Dan and I love coordinating, collaborating, and inspiring all singles.
All right. Well, and the big question, that's the thing I want to hear from our listeners. Were you dating over the past year, or are you getting back into the dating scene now? Call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN with your questions, your stories. Maybe you got a crazy story, or maybe you have tips. Share it. Also, you could share your comments on social media at WLRN Sundial. Okay, I want to hear from both of you on this. Dan, I'll start with you. Sure. How did you get into this work? I mean, becoming an expert in relationships, helping other people date?
Well, you start by being extremely bad at it. And if you're really bad at it, it motivates you to get good at it. So I studied for many years. I went to every workshop under the sun, read every book I could find, until I got pretty good at it for myself. People noticed, they wanted to take my advice, and some had said, hey, you should do this for a living. You ought to like charge for this. And that's how my business started.
All right, wait, hold on a second. What does it mean to be good at it? How do you define success?
Success is okay. Everybody has their own definition of it. My definition of it, at least from men's point of view, is to be able to have options, to be able to have choice. You don't need to make everybody like you, but you need to be able to have the confidence to go and talk to a woman that you like, you're interested in, and make something happen.
Tammy, how about you? How did you get into this?
Our stories differ. I will tell you, I was a prolific dater. Never had a problem getting a date, but I was pretty particular and I didn't apologize for it. And so I ended up hiring a matchmaker. I'm a straight ally. It's how I met my husband. Years later, when I was trying to refer a gay friend, I could not find a gay and lesbian matchmaker. And with a background in news and politics, I did the research and ended up designing a gay and lesbian matchmaking company for gay and lesbian singles that would be straight ally owned and operated.
So wait, Dan said, you know, because everybody's got a different idea of success. So I'm just curious. He said it's options. But I mean, there are people who are just, they're looking for a long-term relationship, right? Not everybody wants options. So is sometimes success that you help people find that one true love if that's what they want?
Well, I would say that if you don't have options, you're more likely to not pick the person that's perfect for you because you'll be picking it out of scarcity. If you have options, you know, you're going to be able to screen more properly. You're not going to be making decisions based upon the fact that you're lonely. You're going to know what it is you're looking for. You're going to have more dating experience under your belt, and you'll be able to pick somebody that's far more compatible. But the good thing about, you know, having a matchmaker work for you is that they can do a lot of that work for you and make sure the person they pick for you is good for you and compatible for you.
All right. Now, listen, Liza, I keep mentioning this as a reminder to people. We're still in a pandemic, but everybody is back out and everything is open, and I see people everywhere. Tammy, how difficult was it to adjust at the beginning of the pandemic when, you know, we're told stay home, everything is shut down anyway?
You bet. It was a challenge. The first day, I treated my company like I was the client because I used to be the client. And I thought, if I have to shelter in place and there are matches out there for me, I want to meet them. I don't want to just sit home alone waiting. So I offered my clients the opportunity to meet via Zoom happy hour. We would coach you, help set the stage, even do a practice so that you can truly keep meeting compatible potential partners during shelter in place, and then ideally meet in person once it's safe to do so. So it worked for us. We have real relationships that began through a virtual introduction.
Dan, how did you pivot?
I'll admit it really did affect my business quite a bit because a lot of what I do is going out there onto the streets in the field and talking to people and socializing, setting up in-person events. I had to switch a lot of doing it to online dating, you know, doing the Zoom calls and things like that. But I still did from time to time go out whenever there was an option to go out.
Again, talking about dating in this era, people starting to get back out, or people, are you dating now? Are you getting back out there? Maybe you've been dating for a while. Or, you know what? How do you feel about vaccination, right? Like, you only want to date people who've been vaccinated, or you don't care. We want to hear your thoughts, your stories, you know, whatever it is you have. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You can also send us your comments on social media, Twitter or Facebook, at WLRN Sundial. We heard from Emily Bender. She met her fiance, Tyler, in Key West. They were both there with family because of the pandemic after they both left their jobs in other states. Here she is.
So I was having a socially distanced cocktail / dance party with two of my best friends on Hibiscus Lane, and Tyler's guest house happened to be on the opposite side of the lane. So when he heard loud music coming from outside his bedroom window, he decided to come out and say hello. At first, I thought he was going to complain, but I think when he realized it was three ladies having a good time, he changed his mind, and the rest is history. I hated when people would tell me when you know, or it will happen when you least expect it, but that's exactly what happened on both fronts for me. And I hope that it brings some faith to others out there still looking for it.
And by the way, just a note, Emily and Tyler recently bought a house in Key West. They're planning to get married there next March. Congratulations to both of them. You know what, Tammy, you know, do you have examples of couples that were successful in finding love during the heart of the pandemic that they actually were able to get through all that craziness and, you know, now it's working out beautifully?
Yes, we do. We had introduced two women that lived in two different cities. They were able to meet in person, have their first date, but then they were looking to travel the next weekend to see each other in the other city, and that's when shelter in place happened. So on their own, they started virtual dating, and they had a date every single night for 7 weeks running. And I joked with them that I don't think I could have done that with my husband. To see someone new every single night for 7 weeks, and they were still doing the courting. I'm all about traditional introductions, courting, and dating, and I think that's what this pandemic has really been a reboot for some of us, to be reminded of that.
Yeah. By the way, Dan, I heard you're actually dating now.
Yes, I'm always dating. I'm always in the field. I enjoy it very much. Yeah, and I really love that story from your viewer or from the listener about the Key West story. That's great.
You know, I mentioned at the beginning, Dan, is that, you know, dating was, look, you meet somebody and you go out with them a couple of times. You get to know them. You get to talk to them, see if there's something there. But during the pandemic, we didn't get to do a lot of that. A lot of people, just as Tammy had mentioned, you know, they were getting to know each other through a screen. Is it the same? I mean, can you still get the same vibe on somebody if you're looking at them on a screen as if you're in person?
I mean, of course it's not the same. It's like eating ice cream with plastic wrap around it.
Oh, okay. Oh, look, my gosh.
it's still better than nothing. I mean, you can be alone and not talk to anybody, but at the very least, you know, you can do it in a safe way and use Zoom if that's what's available to you. You know, I'm not a big fan of online dating, but I still highly recommended it to all of my clients when COVID was going on.
You know, I mean, I read the statistic that at least for one of the dating sites that, you know, the number of people jumping on now, just it went up like 600%. So things are starting to open and people are starting to get out there. Tammy, are you seeing that business picking up again?
Oh, yes. A lot of singles that were very frustrated through pandemic are reaching out for help. Not that they need help to get a date. They're needing help to really be more discerning about who do I really want to meet. They've had a year to really be introspective, maybe work on themselves. I watch some of our clients, and I'm sure Dan can attest, our introverts were thriving working from home and not dealing with the public, whereas our extroverts were very anxious and ready to get out. And so now we're focused on, let's talk about the vaccine. Or do you only want to meet someone that's vaccinated as well? It's a real topic.
Yeah. And I read there's a new term. I'm always trying to keep up with these things that popped up. It described the hesitation and the anxiety that a lot of people are feeling about getting back to dating. I think it's called FODA. Right? The fear of dating again. I think it's like FOMO, but FODA. Mm-hmm. And it was coined by the director of a relationship science dating app, I think, from Hinge. Are you hearing that from clients? Is there a fear of getting back out there, Dan? People a little bit too hesitant?
Oh, you know, I'm a little biased because I live in Miami, and Miami is kind of a lawless place. There were still lots of parties going on over here. But I will say that it has been a constant party every single day in Miami. Lots of events are going on again, you know, and it's as though the pandemic never existed. And people are so much more friendly than ever been before. Miami's a notorious place for unfriendliness, but people really want to get out there and meet and date. Right now is the best time to go out and meet somebody here in Miami.
Now is a good time, as Dan says. Again, I'm talking with a panel of dating experts about dating during a pandemic. Dan Silverman is known as the Miami Matchmaker. He's also a dating coach. And Tammy Shackley is a matchmaker who specializes in queer relationships. And we want to hear from you. Have you been dating? Again, are you a little hesitant to get out there? Or maybe, as Dan said, it's Miami. It's a free-for-all. Get out there. Who knows? Share your thoughts, your stories, or questions. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Or you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We definitely would love to hear from you on this topic. We're hearing about these socially distanced parties during the pandemic, but we also saw a spike in virtual dating with video calls and Zoom. Do you think that's just the trend because of the pandemic, or do you think that that's going to stick around for a while? Tammy, let me start with you.
You bet. I mean, I match, you know, gay and lesbian singles coast to coast in the U.S. And I think those in Florida feel more comfortable because you have so many options to meet for a first date outside, you know, meet on a patio, meet by the beach, go for a walk. And so I think you do feel safer. I think those in colder climates are having a different experience. There's still some that feel comfortable only going out if they're wearing a mask, only going out if they know that it's a socially distanced space or restaurant. So I think it's a case-by-case basis. And I encourage all of our singles, first be self-aware with your comfort level. So kind of set your boundaries and ask the right questions of the partner you're meeting, and also ask their boundaries. So if one person insists on a mask and the other one doesn't, you might not be compatible right now. So I think it's personal preference. I think it's your geography, and I think it's your comfort level.
And that's so interesting, because the just that question of how we feel about the masks, how we feel about vaccines right now, you know, we can't ignore the fact that part of why things are reopening is because of the vaccine. And I think it was dating website OkCupid reported 680% increase in seeing the term vaccinated on the users' profiles that going back to April. Dan, is this something your clients are eager to share or talk about with people? Or again, is it, I kind of like Tammy said, maybe, I don't know. How do you bring that up? How do you even just like, hey, I got vaccinated. What about you?
It's funny because, well, at least in person, if you're going to walk up to somebody and like give them a hug or shake their hand, a lot of the time you can say, oh, I'm vaccinated, you know, and then they'll be okay with it. I kind of share that anyway, but it's easy to bring it up. I mean, you can, it's not a big deal if you say it in a playful, jokey, flirty way. I think it's a great thing to do.
And Tammy, what about you? I mean, like, you know, because you said you may not be compatible if you both aren't really on the same boat with this. So you may want to say, look, let's meet here because we could be socially distanced. Is it just a matter of bringing it up, or is there a strategy so that you don't feel uncomfortable?
Good question. I think it's a new social status because, like Dan said, folks will lead with, I'm fully vaxxed. Is he? And then I have to go back and ask if he hasn't already shared. And so there's even an online dating site called Grindr, and they were advertising vax for vax, meaning I'm vaccinated, seeking someone who is as well. And I think that's fine, that if you consider that a real issue and you're seeking someone compatible with you. I also have friends, I live in the South, and I have friends that aren't vaccinated and are very vocal about that. And then it's our option to decide whether we want to still hang out with them, whether we feel comfortable indoors or outdoors, but I certainly want to see my friends and I respect their personal preference.
Now, both of you are matchmakers. So I wanted to come back to that and just ask how that process works. Because look, you have all these apps. Most of the apps, my understanding, though, really are kind of more for women in making choices of what men they want to date. Then you have the typical, you know, the websites, you know, the big websites that have been around for a while, and people can post their profile, and then supposedly there's an algorithm that connects you with other people. How do you do it? You have a client, Dan, and they tell you what they're looking for, and then what, you go out there looking for it? How does it work?
Yeah, that's a good question because every matchmaker does it differently. So I can tell you the many ways that matchmakers recruit. So essentially, the client will tell exactly what they're looking for, and then the matchmaker has to tell them that if it's feasible or if it's not. If it's not feasible, then they explain why and they try to get to the bottom of what's really important and what would be compatible. Once you find that out, then the matchmaker will hire recruiters to go out. They might go out themselves to recruit and go to events. They'll use online dating profiles to scout. They have a database that they collect matches and matches with in order to set up. And they'll even contact other matchmakers. In fact, Tammy and I work together quite frequently because whenever I get you know, a gay or a lesbian client that comes to me, I know Tammy will probably do a better job since she has a national reach. I can refer that client to her.
Tammy, yeah, you know, and the other thing too is I'm wondering, like, on the websites, you can look and see if the person, if you like anything about them or not. But I don't know, is it easier, you know, if you have somebody who's helping you do that instead?
I enjoyed being set up with someone that had been vetted for me when I was a client, that, you know, I wasn't looking to have kids. They set me up with a man that wasn't looking to have kids. That's a huge compatibility factor. And now today, as a matchmaker, everyone I introduce has done the same interview with me and the same criminal background check. So in my case, I interview a single for an hour and a half to really get to know them. So it's almost like I've been on the first, second, and third date with them to know what they're seeking in compatibility. So I know who to match them with and who absolutely they would not be compatible with, no matter how great their online profile would look, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm going to finish with this, both of you. I want to hear your thoughts on this. South Florida in general, Miami, good place to date or no? Dan.
It is an extremely difficult place to find a long-term quality relationship. It is very fun if you are just looking to have fun. However, it is possible to meet someone here, but it is difficult. That's why I have a job in the first place.
Yeah. Tammy, what about you and you know, the LGBTQ community, like, easy to date here or no?
Right. I hear from my gay and lesbian singles there that Miami can be a very small market. And so we have to do our due diligence to make sure you haven't already met. And then I think it depends on the age range, both that you are and then what you're seeking. A lot of older men, for example, will tell me, you know, if they're just here, you know, to winter, they're probably not the guy for me, that I really am looking for someone to be with, not just on season, but year round. And so I hear the same thing, you know, that Dan hears, that it can be hard to find a long-term sustainable relationship in Miami, but don't give up. I mean, whoever you're seeking is seeking you too. And that's our job as matchmakers, is that we have so many success stories. It's our job to encourage those singles that we promise there's at least one compatible partner for you, no matter what your preference is.
Well, that is good to know that there is some hope for even people like me. I want to thank my matchmakers for today, dating coach and matchmaker Dan Silverman and Tammy Shackley, matchmaker who specializes in queer relationships. Dan, Tammy, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Let us know if we can help, Lewis.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Lewis. You ought to give us a call sometime.
I should be sharing this on air anyway. All right, guys, thank you so much. Well, still to come, many of us are getting back to work. One family member's having a hard time with this change. It's your dog, and you know it. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Many offices that have been closed since the beginning of the pandemic are slowly bringing workers back. It'll be a rough adjustment for those of us who've become used to working at home. It'll also be a major adjustment for our pets, who have gotten used to having us around all the time. How do you know if your dog is experiencing separation anxiety, and how can you help? Sundial producer Leslie Ovalle spoke with Mark Rollins. He's a professor and chair of the philosophy department at the University of Miami and has written a range of books exploring animal sensitivity and awareness.
You had a dog named Brennan, and with him you experienced firsthand what can happen when animals struggle with separation anxiety. Tell us that story. What happened?
Well, there's actually lots of stories. Brennan was sold to me as a wolf. I think it's very likely he was a wolf dog mix rather than a pure wolf. But he certainly did have separation anxiety, and this sort of emerged very early on. Where if I left him in my house, he would just destroy everything he could lay his little jaws on. You know, when he was a cub. So there was one episode when he was much older. When I was traveling between Ireland and Wales, it was for Christmas actually. I was going back to see my parents, and on the way over to Wales, there were no problems, no issues. But on the way back, I had to leave him in the car because there wasn't anywhere else to put him. He wasn't allowed upstairs in the ferry or anything like that. So he stayed in the car. It was very cold. There were no issues about heat or anything like that. But about an hour into the voyage, I get this call over the tannoy. Could the owner of such and such a vehicle come down to the car deck immediately? And Brennan had just completely torn the car apart. You know, the seats were gone, the steering wheel was chewed, the gear stick was chewed, the ceiling was hanging down in kind of shards, you know, in strips, sorry. And that was just what it was like to sort of live with him. I mean, the upshot was that he basically, wherever I went, he had to come too. You know, any sort of, I took him into work with me when I worked in my first job at the University of Alabama. He had to come into classes with me every time. Any socializing I did, bars, parties, that sort of thing, he had to come along too, you know. So we were barely out of each other's eyeshot for more than a few minutes at a time for over a decade, you know. And because bad things would happen if I left him on his own. Once, when I lived in Ireland, he actually chewed his way through a wall. It was a sort of it wasn't a stone wall. It was wooden with, but he chewed his way through on an attempt, I think, to get out to the backyard. But then I came home and there was this big hole in the wall leading out from the kitchen to the backyard.
Wow. Well, I have an 11-pound Havanese, so I don't think I have to worry about her chewing through the wall, but maybe chewing up the furniture or my shoes. Did you learn any lessons from that experience from Brennan? You know, Shadow, the dog that you have now, is it any different with him or is it similar?
Oh, he's he does have certainly, when I'm leaving the house or when any of my family members are leaving the house, he will go berserk, running between the front door and the front window to watch us and barking, you know, which some might take as a sign of separation anxiety. I don't really see it as anxiety. I think it's just sort of more frustration that he's not going with us. But he's pretty chilled. When I come back, he's usually been asleep and he's happy to see us, and there's no trail of destruction or anything like that.
Yeah, and so do you know if some dogs are more prone to experiencing anxiety? Does the breed of the dog have anything to do with it?
Not that I know of. To the best of my knowledge, there's no firm evidence linking breeds to separation anxiety. It's a highly variable, highly individual phenomenon, as far as I know.
And you've mentioned some of these, but I want to go through some of the signs for a dog owner. How would they know that their dog is experiencing this anxiety? What should we look out for?
Signs can vary. The eating one's car or eating a hole through the wall in one's house, that's a quite extreme expression.
Right.
Other expressions, there's a sort of behavior shadow exhibits. If that were ratcheted up a couple of notches, that might be somewhere in the vicinity of separation anxiety. Sometimes you'll have a little present to clear up when you come home. You know, dogs express their anxiety by urinating or defecating occasionally. It's so again, it varies from one dog to another.
Right. But we'll notice when something's off. You know, it's our companion, so we'll see that. What are some best practices people can do to help our dogs relieve that anxiety or help them get through that?
With Brennan, the wolf dog, I mean, the strategy I tended to use was just to keep him as exhausted as I possibly could. So, you know, if I had to go out and leave him, which I only did rarely, but if I absolutely positively had to leave him in the house, then, you know, we'd have to go for a 10-mile run or a bike ride or something like that beforehand. And then the idea is he'll sleep for a bit and I can get out and get back and, you know. But I think, in my experience, generally, a tired dog is a happy dog. And I think that's the most important thing anyone can do for a dog that has anxiety, separation anxiety issues, or anxiety issues in general, actually.
Right. And also on the other side, it's the anxiety that we might have from leaving our pets at home, maybe as we go back into the office and into work.
That is a very good point. It'll be interesting to see how this sort of plays out. But yes, I mean, there's been a slew of studies done on the role dogs played in helping their owners during the pandemic. And, you know, I think one study done by the University of York in the UK, I think 87% of owners stated that their dog helped them cope emotionally with the pandemic. 73% said that their dog kept them fit and active. 94% said they had a positive effect on their family. And 95% said they couldn't imagine being without their pet during the pandemic. So yeah, it cuts both ways. Perhaps the separation anxiety will be in a more sort of human focused direction. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can count me in on all those statistics. It's been the best just having a dog during this time. I've also heard, because our dog, we actually got her during the pandemic, and we did some training camps with her, because my first dog, I have no idea what I'm doing. And they told us that it was also good when we leave them alone at home or when we come back, not to be too overly emotional in saying hi or bye. And that kind of helps them with that anxiety. Have you found that, or?
Yes, yeah. You certainly don't want to make a big deal about leaving or coming back. That is right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. The bigger a deal you make, then the bigger a deal it becomes to the dog. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you just say goodbye and hello, and that's pretty much it.
I'm speaking with Mark Rowlands. He is a professor and chair of the philosophy department at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Miami. He's written a range of books exploring animal sensitivity and awareness. Our pets have gotten used to having us home during the pandemic. Now, some of us are planning to return to work outside our home. We're talking about how we can make that transition easier on our dogs. You can find links to his work and photos of our newsroom's furry, wet-nosed co-workers on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Is there certain things we can do to prepare ourselves and prepare our dogs for when, you know, we have to go back to work?
Well, I suppose, I mean, if you're going from, you know, being at home 100% of the time to being away from home 100% of the time during the day, then I suppose that would be a hard transition for at least some dogs. I suspect some dogs will be glad of the peace and quiet, you know, but for some dogs that would be a difficult transition. So yeah, maybe starting off by just going out for an hour or two at a time and then coming back and gradually, if that option is available to you, you know, gradually building up to the 8 or 9 hours you'll be away. I mean, I'd hope that one of the effects of the pandemic would be that people realize they didn't actually have to be physically on site at work all the time, and they might stay home a bit more. But I don't know if that's gonna happen.
Yeah, and you know, some shelters and rescue groups, they've seen the number of people looking for dogs double since the pandemic began. And I'm one of those people. Like I said, I welcomed a puppy into my family back in August. Do you have any recommendations on what people should consider if they're thinking about getting a dog and, you know, having that addition to their family?
The most important thing is, am I in a position to give this dog a decent life? Am I in a position to exercise it appropriately, to give it the sort of companionship it needs? What kind of life will this dog have if it lives with me? I think that's the most important question anyone can ask themselves.
Right. It's like a two-way street. Not only, you know, this dog is going to bring me joy and, you know, make me go out on walks and maybe be more fit, but what can I provide to this dog as well?
Yeah, it's ask not what your dog can do for you kind of thing. Ask what you can do for your dog. That's the way to think about it, I suspect.
That's good. I like that. As someone who studied philosophy, you know, that's been your professional career. How have your dogs helped you see and understand the world differently?
Oh, so many different ways. I mean, I'll give you one example. I became a father for the first time at the ripe old age of 44. And when I did, the house was also occupied by Nina, who was a rather ferocious German Shepherd Malamute mix, and Tess, who was the daughter of Brennan, the wolf dog, mm-hmm. that I talked about earlier. And I was kind of, you know, a bit concerned about how these new Tess was a sweetheart, but she did have very highly developed predatory instincts, you know, So I was a little worried about how this sort of new house sharing operations would um, will go down, you know. But in fact, I needn't worry at all, because they turned out to be sort of far better parents than I was. And I mean, if my son so much as squeaked in the middle of the night, I'd have these two cold noses pressed up against my face, sitting here, "Get up, you negligent parent! Your son needs you." And I was always just astonished by the kind of toleration, patience, kindness almost that these dogs exhibited to my son as he was sort of crawling over them, playing with their teeth and stuff like that, you know. And so it occurred to me that qualities like patience and toleration, these are moral qualities. And so I got thinking about this and thinking about it some more, and in the end I wrote a book called Can Animals Be Moral, basically arguing that some animals can actually act for moral motivations. So the inspiration for that book, it's not all about dogs, but the inspiration for that book was basically those two dogs and their cold noses pressed up against my face.
That was Mark Rowlands, professor and chair of the philosophy department at the University of Miami. Much of his research focused on animals like dogs and wolves, speaking with Sundial producer Leslie Ovalle. By the way, we want to hear from you. How are you coping with heading back to the office? Are you still planning to work from home? Send us photos of your furry coworkers that have kept you company during this time. Just tag us on our social media, WLRN Sundial. That's our program for this Wednesday, June 9th. Coming up tomorrow, food insecurity remains a critical issue in South Florida, and with students fully out of school, the problem becomes even worse in South Florida. There's a dispute now over which organization will be responsible for feeding those in need in Broward and Palm Beach County. We're going to hear from Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Well, that's our program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. As always, please stay safe, take care of each other. This program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.